Kevin Costner goes west, Bruce Willis cannot be broken, and Disney's fifth or sixth animation renaissance this week on 302010. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to 302010, the Laser Time Network's weekly pop culture time machine, taking you back 30, 20, and 10 years back into our history of pop culture, anniversaries for movies, TV, video games, music, and so very much more. Hi, I'm one of your hosts, Chris Santista. Who else is with me?
Well, for the second week in a row, I get to praise Philadelphia, but I am very upset that Philadelphia caused that horrible train crash in which I was the lone survivor, Diana Goodman.
Sometimes your enemies are best friends, Diana. That's me. Who else?
It's me, Sarah.
Sarah, sounding a little different because why? You are
from a quarantine bunker. We had an exposure in this house. Weirdly, not due to anyone's fault in this house, but it happened. And the place that I usually record cannot be disinfected from my other family members at this point. So I had to move the recording place to my bedroom. Ooh, la, la, la. Ooh, that, my bedroom.
So much crushed velvet.
That's not what I thought you were going to say. I thought you were going to talk about your incredible abilities at the wagon wheel Watusi. Very disappointed.
And that explains if Sarah sounds a little different, so no need to comment on that. But also to tell everybody out there to be careful. For fuck's sake, this thing is now closer to me. We have been very careful. My girl has not been able to work in months because of this. And we've been mostly inside, and this is still surrounding me and getting closer than it's ever been. So I encourage everyone out there to wear a mask and be more careful than usual, especially around your susceptible friends and relatives. End of soapboxing. But
don't go anywhere where you have to take off your mask.
Yes. Yes.
Don't go to a bar. Don't go to a restaurant. I'm sorry. Thanksgiving is at home. But there are a lot of movies to talk about that you can watch. Because we're hitting all the Thanksgiving movies. This is like our most packed episode ever.
Yeah, it's pretty big. It's pretty big.
And
it's,
oh my God. It just keeps going.
And this show is executive produced by our buddy T.L. Foster. I say that because I saw him this weekend and many other fine people at patreon.com/latertime. Thank you to all our supporters. We got some really fun stuff coming your way, including a new sick of Star Wars. Again, everything's been real rough over here in light of COVID. Just hang with us. I feel so exasperated. Thank you for letting me ramble a little bit, because we are going to get into the week of November 20th through the 26th, 1990, 2000, and 2010, to tell you about all the great movies and TV shows. I have a real personal thing here in the 90s, but let's get started with 1990, November 20th through the 26th. This is your first of three portals into the past. We are going 30 years back. And wow, Margaret Thatcher resigns as prime minister and is replaced by John Major.
And, spoiler for episode 10 of The Crown, by the way.
spoiler.
My mayor comes in, like, your body is a wonderland.
Spoiler, and also the end of punk rock. Who are you going to mention if not Thatcher?
Seriously, season 4 of The Crown has been so great. And Gillian Anderson is absolutely slaying it as Margaret Thatcher. She's like,
what? I didn't know that.
Every now and then, like, you feel a little bad for her because, like, she's middle class and she's like having to go hang out with the royals and not knowing the protocol and being all confused. And then she says something so monstrous about, oh, half the country's unemployed. Well, that's the sort of thing that happens when you don't have enough grit. And it's like, fuck you.
I feel like she wrote the playbook for some people.
Yeah, Kushner. It's very Kushner-esque.
Is there anything Gillian Anderson can't do?
I thought it was act. I thought she said she was retired and hated the business.
Would be terrible. No, I don't think that's true. Last year, 2 years ago, she came out with that great series, Sex Education.
Right. Maybe I'm thinking of just the X-Files. She's like, never again. I'm not doing that anymore.
Pop up on American Gods, where she played Lucille Ball. She played David Bowie. I mean, and she did a great job.
She was Hannibal Lecter's psychiatrist.
Oh, she was so good on that.
And this, man, this sent me into a loop yesterday because it's hard to remember even why this was controversial. MTV bans Madonna's new music video this week, 30 years ago, for Justify My Love, as it is too sexually explicit. And is it?
I watched it again, and it's maybe you should only show it after 9 p.m. That would have worked fine because it's suggestive. There's a lot of, she makes out with a woman. She's sort of like rubbing her hands all over herself. And there's, you know, some kind of BDSM sort of imagery. But yeah, no, I mean, it's on YouTube right now and it's not flagged as explicit.
It is.
Game?
Huh?
Is it more sexual than Wicked Game?
I don't think so, personally.
No. I don't think so.
Because there's more skin in that video. And like, because I remember finally seeing this in the late 90s when I think the first music video, at least for Madonna, to be released on VHS.
Yeah.
And it was a huge bestseller because MTV basically told you cannot see this. Yet they were running clips of it. I remember there's a Wayne's World sketch with Madonna that parodies this. The whole world was talking about it, yet the place you go to see videos would show it to you. It's the first music video to premiere on Nightline. Not a joke. I think
that's in a week or so.
Yes.
Where that becomes a huge thing where they're like, well, we're going to show it so we can talk about it. And everyone's like, you're showing this on like ABC on a news program, a 5-minute video about like being sexy in black and white and making out.
Yeah.
Voyeurism.
Yeah.
Sexy times.
Ted Koppel really helping you guide that boner. I mean, I know it was important because I did love sexy music videos as a teenager. But like, yeah, I finally went over to a friend's house in like the late 90s and she had the videotape, which I think, I don't know if it was on purpose or clever marketing, but like it couldn't really mark itself. It was sold very nondescriptly with just a sticker that said, this is Madonna's Justify My Love video. And I watched it and I'm like, that's it. Jesus, yeah. We were hella puritanical in 1990. Holy shit.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I bring this up every time we talk about sexy music videos, but I have this distinct memory of a VH1 show. You know how they would like have like maybe half-hour shows where they would just group together a lot of the same themed sort of music videos? Mm-hmm. And this one was like all sexual music videos. Mm. And like I remember the opening credits to the show had like a train going into a tunnel. It was like thinking like, all right, here we go. And I would love to see if that's somewhere. I need to look for it on YouTube, see if that show, that block is somewhere.
I vaguely remember what you were talking about. Yeah, the thematical blocks of older music videos before that channel was basically owned by New York, the person, not the state. And also in the news, a long news segment, Mick Jagger and Jerry Hall marry. What? It's not entirely legal and they split in 99?
Yeah. Well, I don't think they filed the paperwork exactly, but it's like they've been together a really long time. Mm-hmm. And so they actually had something of a wedding. And then they split up in 1999. And now she's married to Rupert Murdoch. What the actual fuck?
I don't get it. Woman, you still look great.
Yes.
Do you need money after being married to Mick Jagger? Are you sure? What is going on? Why would you marry that fucking troglodyte toad? Oh my God.
Why would you be with like one of the coolest people ever and the least cool people ever? Like, is she just working her way from one end to the other and like next is going to be like the second coolest person in the world?
Wow. I guess, she will have a diverse Rolodex of experiences after all this. Congrats, I guess, is in order. Anyway, let's move on to the movies of 1990, November 20th through the 26th, and it is big, big, big. Home Alone is still number one at the box office and will be throughout the entire holiday season, I believe. That's just me guessing. I have not looked ahead. I just remember what the world felt like. And I wish Brett was here to pronounce this the way he wrote it down. Three men and a little lady. He wrote the first movie down as Three Men and a Little Baby, which sounded pejorative to me. Oh, little baby. The sequel to the Leonard Nimoy classic, which is a super fun, accurate sentence to say. Fiona Shaw, Robin Wiseman, Christopher Kazanov, Nancy Travis, Ted Danson, Steve Guttenberg, Tom Selleck, Three Men and a Little Lady.
From Touchstone Pictures, America's Funniest Family is back. Tom Selleck.
We are building an office for 12,000 people. You can't put a bathroom on every other floor.
Steve Guttenberg.
What are you doing in there?
Hi. And Ted Danson.
I loved your last commercial.
A lot of people say that when they watch, that they really
believed that I was constipated.
Three men and a little lady.
How come none of you are married?
Rated PG.
Man, I didn't rewatch this because I saw this in theaters.
I watched it, and I tell you what, I loved it.
I didn't have a problem with, dude, just yesterday we were getting cat food in Walmart and I was stealing some stuff, and to divert everybody, the song from the movie came on, Bad Boys, and I'm just dancing around. And you do that when you steal from Walmart, so they're like, this guy, he can't be up to no good. He's dancing around to an 80s three-minute little lady movie theme. But the ending haunts me of Ted Danson screaming, "You don't think I'm constipated," and tearing off his skin.
That's inside of my brain for such a long time. And I remember being a little kid and seeing that and being like, oh, no.
Yeah, it's horrifying because I was young enough to be duped. Like, I didn't know that was him playing the preacher. We're spoiling the movie, but, you know, it's 3 minutes
late.
Oh,
no.
But that really stuck in my brain pan for such a long time. And seeing it again this weekend, because it's on Disney Plus, like,
hit. Wow.
I just enjoyed the crap out of it. I don't know.
I enjoy the
point of it is that Nancy Travis, who's the mom of the baby and the three guys who take care of it, they all live together, but now she's going to go to England and get married. And then they're like, no, we have to stop this.
No, they're like, okay, like, you know, we all have to live our lives. We all have to move on. We can't all just like live in this weird clubhouse together. And then, so she's like, I'm marrying the director of my play, who's a very fancy British man. And then they go to England. She takes the little lady with her, who's played by a very good child actor, by the way. Usually, you know, I'm not a fan of child acting, but she does a very good job, not too precocious. And then they get there and Tom Selleck and the Goot are like, all right, we were kind of rude about them leaving. We should probably go for the wedding and surprise them for the wedding. And so they get there and they're like meeting everyone. And then they find out that the director who's going to be the husband has evil plans to send the little lady to a boarding school. And she's like five, and they're like, that can't happen. And so hijinks ensue. Mainly a lot of hijinks of Tom Selleck and Fiona Shaw driving around the English countryside in a little tiny European car, which is pretty fun because they're both tall people. And yeah, I don't know. It's fun. And then it all culminates in a great like wedding, like, oh, we're getting married. Let's race and try to stop it. I loved it. And Tom Selleck I'm sorry, he's very charming in this. And so is Ted Danson. And Steve Guttenberg is also there. So.
Damn. The one guy I almost look like is just thrown off like that. Okay. Yeah, 3 Men and a Little Lady. Sadly, no ghost in this one. Please listen. I remember, was it 3 years ago, Di? We talked about Three Men and a Baby. Yeah. You know, that wonderfully timeless tale. Can three human beings who aren't a woman take care of a single baby?
Yep. Well, that's the math. It turns out three men equal one woman when it comes to caretaking. Yeah. Yes.
And my favorite takeaway from the first movie, there's a lot more heroin in it than you remember. and this is fantastic. I watched this semi-recently with our buddy Sam, who you may have heard on another podcast, Mrs. Sarah. We got Robert Davi, Bill Paxton, Maria Conchita Alonso, Ruben Blades, Gary Busey, and Danny Glover in Predator 2.
He has thermal image vision, optic prism body armor, laser-guided smart weapons, all-terrain mobility, hazardous atmosphere compensators, and this Thanksgiving, he's in town with a few days to kill. Predator 2, rated R.
I love Predator 2.
No.
Yeah, I love it. I love it, love it, love it.
I wanted to love it. I really, really did. I thought that's a great idea of like, yeah, if you're going to do another Predator movie, put him in the urban jungle, not the regular jungle, in the far off world of 1997, where Los Angeles is a war zone between Colombians and Jamaicans. Drug gangs?
That's the greatest thing about the movie is that the whole it's set in this future of 1997, where 1990, remember, so it's 7 years in the future. Everybody in the police department is dressed by the stylist behind Color Me Bad. There's a lot. There's a lot of shoulder pads and mustard colored shirts.
Of course, that's
it's hysterical. It's violent. I can objectively see why it's not as good as Predator 1. But I haven't heard me say that before. I was exposed to Predator 1 in my mid-20s. I never saw it as a kid, so I saw these very close to one another. And I want to give it a little credit, just as a throwaway gag from Stan Winston Studios, because they worked on both of these Fox films. You go inside the Predator ship and you see a skull of a xenomorph from Alien. And it wasn't really meant to be like a canonical thing, but then Dark Horse Comics took it and ran with it. And I think kids, if they're aware of these franchises at all, consider them part of the same universe. And it's kind of one of the first movie series to do that.
That's true. That is true. But it took 17 years to get from Predator 2 to Alien.
Not if you were playing video games or reading comics. They were doing it for decades before that. And I was. So like, I love that about it. And it's also like, there's not a lot of great Predator movies. Can we say
that? No, there's one.
I don't hate
there
Predators.
Really is one.
I don't.
I still haven't seen Predators. I've seen both of the Aliens versus Predator combined. You have one really good movie there.
Yeah.
There's like parts of the first one and parts of the second one are really good, but all in all, or overall, they're pretty good.
Shane Black's.
So it does really sound then that, like, no matter who wins, we all lose.
but this is just like pulpy, super 80s, Total Recall-esque without the Schwarzenegger who refused to come back and be in this movie because of money, but he was supposed to be. Mm-hmm. The only thing I remarked upon, I grew up, you know, I just saw Danny Glover as like a movie star. He'd say, I'm getting too old for this shit, Riggs, and like, I forget whose name is what. But when I watched this as an adult, like, oh, he is really fucking old. he is way too old to be the star of an action movie. It is not terribly convincing.
Yeah, he's too old for this shit. He's not just an action star. He is the Predator's main prey.
Yeah.
He is such an amazing hunter that the Predator doesn't want to kill him first, wants to kill him last, and wants to kill everyone around him first just to piss him off.
Come to this planet to hunt a 50-year-old black guy with bad knees. Like, what the fuck? It doesn't make that much sense, but it's just like, I wish it was more off the wall.
Yeah.
But I don't know. If you haven't heard Elm Street Nightmare on Patreon, it's directed by Stephen Hopkins right off of Nightmare on Elm Street 5, The Dream Child, which is a fascinating, terrible film. And this is less terrible, but it's like, it's got that stank on it that I really love. Just like ambitious and fuck it, balls to the wall, like weirdness. I don't know. I think it's a super fun watch. And I think most people grew up watching it on cable all the time. And it's not as good as Predator, but I think in a new world where there's been four more movies with the Predator in it, it might be the second best Predator movie.
Yeah.
Might be.
It's a pretty big drop off between one and two, but I didn't feel like I wasted my time. It's another one of those where it's like, it's got some fun parts. A lot of it is really stupid. And eventually. I mean, part of the problem is they frame some of it like it's a mystery. Like, who could be doing these things? And I'm like, I know what movie I walked into. I know who's doing this.
But I like that they have to reference something that may have happened in a Mexican. It wasn't a Mexican. I've actually been to the location where they shot the first Predator. It's Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. But I think they're in a completely different place in the story. But the world doesn't know about the Predator 10 years later. I think it's pretty brilliant. It is one of the batshittiest sequels I've ever seen in my life. I can't recommend it enough. I am hyper conflicted about talking about the next film. Filled with dread I was, but I did it. I popped on this mini series of a movie and rewatched it for the audience. Hopefully it won't take us as long to discuss it as it did for me to watch it. Rodney A. Grant, Graham Greene, Mary McDonald, Kevin Costner, Dances with Wolves, the greatest movie ever.
We had an officer who's worth something lying here.
A Civil War hero leaves the battlefield for the frontier, cut off from everything he knows. Changed forever by the people who call him Dances with Wolves.
I will not forget you.
K. Kevin Costner dances with wolves. Rated PG-13.
Oh man, I watched this as well for the first time.
Now, the number one question is, how long of a cut did you watch?
I watched the normal one.
Some of the streaming sites are fucking with you because this was released a year later back to theaters and onto VHS as an extended cut, which is 4 hours.
Yep.
The theatrical cut is 3 hours, 1 minute.
That's...
I watched the extended cut for you, the viewer.
Wow.
And I found like a guide online explaining like what got added and changed. The extended cut is completely worthless. It adds nothing.
Oh my gosh, Diana, you are our MVP for this episode.
Oh.
Calling it now because
you're
that is interminable. At the non-extended length. I mean, it is so long and it's also like kind of good.
I know. That's
I think it's a really good movie, but it's like there's a lot to get into.
It's really the
it
thing.
It is slow. It is very
there's
slow.
There's also parts that are so embarrassing.
That is my biggest takeaway is coming out of this. I learned that Diana both contacted our friend Sonia Ballantyne. Like, is this hated or just like laughed at in the native community? And she's like, Diana just asked me that.
Yeah, well, I had to reach out to Sonia from Live from the Pool House because I know she's First Nations, and I said like, I don't want to tokenize you and make you the spokeswoman for all Native peoples everywhere, you know, and she's free to, you know, return the favor if she ever wants to ask, what did you think of Yentl?
Yeah. Does anybody wonder what straight white men think about stuff, or is it just all over the place?
We are. No, that's default.
We're good. You
know. Yeah, I was like, is 30 years on, you know, how do Native people feel about this? And she sent me a bunch of memes, mostly making fun of Mary McDonnell and her very modern hairdo, and being like, we take in this white girl, and what's the first white boy who shows up? She just runs off.
That part is like, and they even kind of address it in the movie where they're like, well, they're both white.
That,
yeah, no harm, no foul.
I don't watch every movie for this show, and Diana said this is coming up. I'm like, fuck no, I'm not watching this movie. I said to Diana, you can call me Big Chief No Way of the I Don't Want to Tribe. I am not watching this movie in my best Regis Philbin. And but I watched it and I was like, I was so mad at myself. Like, this is not as bad as I thought it was going to be. In fact, it's to look upon. It's gorgeous.
Yeah.
It's some of the best. I have never seen it in HD on a big screen. I haven't watched it since the special edition DVD that I bought. Sorry, my background, for people who don't know, I feel like I've talked about this recently in a couple of shows. My dad is obsessed with Native American culture. Grew up.
Most of my dads are.
He grew up.
I feel like this is a lot of dad's favorite movies.
I grew up, he took me to a bunch of reservations and a lot of, I'm saying this as an excessively bored preteen and teenager. He took me to all this stuff, introduced me to a lot of tribal chiefs, I went to annual ceremonies of Native American culture. I was steeped in it. I remember being mildly embarrassed when he started going to formal events in denim and a dream catcher bolo top. Yeah, my dad was real into this stuff. So I was steeped in this stuff. This,
I love it so much.
This is the first rated R movie my parents ever took me to.
Wow.
And I saw it and I knew nothing about it. And I came out... This is so weird to say, with like a Star Warsian appreciation of non-animated and genre film. I loved it. I dreamt about it the whole weekend. I couldn't stop thinking about it. It was also the first sex scene I ever saw in a theater. Because I think my first rated R movie in the theater was A Babysitter Took Me to Betsy's Wedding. I don't remember why that's rated R. I think it's just language. But a first thrusting sex sequence I've ever seen. So I grew up loving this film, and then later on I discover Goodfellas, realize it stole all the Dances with Wolves, stole all the Goodfellas Oscars, and I hated it like the rest of society, but it's not, even as Sonia, like, there's laughable parts in it, but it's not considered by Native people to be particularly egregiously awful in terms of depictions.
That's one thing I found doing a whole bunch of research. We haven't really explained what the movie's about.
No, sorry.
Yeah, it's Avatar.
a suicidal Civil War guy tries to kill himself, fails, but looks like a hero, gets stationed in the middle of nowhere with nobody else, and ends up befriending a bunch of local Sioux Native Americans. I'm gonna try watching the I word. And that part alone, I thought, like, and I'm not trying to disparage Native Americans as aliens. It reminded me, I like the Arrival type stuff of like trying, like, no, they don't, they can't speak the same language. They both live here and they have to learn how to communicate through hand signals. And then the Mary McDonald character comes on, like, this is the stupidest version of Arrival I've ever seen in my life. How she conjures like new words in English out of nowhere in her 30s.
And yeah, well, because she's a white girl who was orphaned on the prairie and then was taken in by this tribe and raised as one of them. And is one of them. But yeah, they sort of recruit her to be like, you can speak some English, right? Can you talk to this white guy, find out what his deal is? I mean, looking at a historical context is fucking fascinating.
Yeah.
Because that is one thing I saw from a lot of Native American actors. There's a documentary called Real Engine, R-E-E-L, Engine, that's about a Native American filmmaker, like, talking to other actors and filmmakers about depictions of Native American people. And they all say, this is a fucking landmark for them.
Mm-hmm.
Of, they're not just the bad guys. They're not just the good guys. They're like well-rounded people.
Yeah.
They're actual characters who are shown respect, especially Graham Greene as Kicking Bird, who's like, they're not all a bunch of noble savages and, oh, it's too bad we had to kill them, but we did, so never mind. Where it's like, he's like a regular guy you want to go have a beer with. He's not like magic. You know, he's like, his wife gives him shit.
And he goes home to a tribe and he's got zealot friends and he's got peacenik friends. And
yeah, and he's like, oh, we could go kill the white guy, but I don't know. I mean.
And also they have, like, he has a sense of humor. Mm-hmm. They're like jokes and stuff. Like, it's 100% a very good, well-rounded depiction.
Yeah. So, but I mean, then
even though Graham Greene is the default for every kind of Native person on American cinema. But other than that, I wouldn't mind naming my first kid Ten Bears. That is the greatest name of all time.
Ten Bears is pretty cool.
Ten Bears.
Yeah. So, I mean, the making of this, this was a huge surprise for everyone that this is like a good movie. We have had no serious Westerns for like ever. Last ones we talked about were the Young Guns movies.
I'm baffled by it because I even went back and looked, and like Kevin Costner had been in like Bull Durham and Untouchables and Field of Dreams, but like those are his hits. And so I don't know where he gets the gall to like option something and then make a sweeping epic, which I guess it was filmed kind of cheap, but
yeah, but like he had trouble with the fundraising. He ended up dropping his own money into it. And people were like, no one wants to watch a big sprawling Western. And now it's the highest grossing Western of all time.
Yeah. Bada bing, bada boom. A half a billion of 1990 money. Just at the domestic box office, it was an instant sensation. And it's in a way that's not as cynical as Unforgiven. It is a nice undoing of the Western.
Yeah,
and
where it's a revisionist Western in that, you know, the Indians are largely good guys, or at least they're just guys. They're treated with sympathy, and the white folks, some of them are good. A lot of them are giant fucking assholes. I mean, that's one of my big problems is it does still fall into some Western tropes. Like, there are bad Indians. The Pawnee are just bad.
And
I
they're
guess.
All Pawnee. I had not seen it in a Parks and Rec context.
Yeah, but I gave like, oh, that's right. Mm-hmm. Because Parks and Rec does reference a lot of Native American stuff, I think, in a very sweet, gentle way.
I believe the light history. I love when I can read about history, but sometimes my brain glazes over. But what I took away from it is that, like, the Sioux were basically like the Americans to the Pawnee. They were the slow, vastly shrinking minority that the Sioux kept encroaching on. And therefore, they behaved a little pissed off occasionally. And, but, you know, they died out faster.
Yeah. And, obviously, it's all super oversimplified.
But
the fact that the Indians or Native Americans, I like First Nations better. I think we should pick that one up from Canada. But the First Nations people are so sympathetic without it being super patronizing.
Yeah.
That is a big deal. And
this was based on a book, right?
Yes.
Right. It's based on a book. The guy who wrote the book, like, used to couch surf at Kevin Costner's house.
Yeah.
Like a buddy of his.
He wrote a book. He wrote the movie Kevin Costner. I forget what it's called, like a 1983 semi-Western. And Kevin Costner convinced him to continue writing it, even though this began as a failed screenplay treatment. He convinced them to turn it into a novel to see if it could find success in that medium, and then they could make the movie.
Wow.
And then eventually, I believe homeboy, what's his name, Michael Blake, who also wrote the screenplay for the film, wrote several sequels, and that I meant to research it more because I couldn't find anything. Kevin Costner has a no sequel policy, and like, okay, really?
Oh.
So yeah, he's, because I mean, if you remember the movies that he's done, there could have easily been a Bull Durham, Untouchables, Robin Hood sequel, and he just doesn't do them.
Tin Cup 2.
For Love of Game. And that was another shocking thing to find out. I have generally considered Kevin Costner one of the worst major movie stars in my lifetime. I think he sucks. And I always thought he was my generation's John Voight. And then it turns out, no, Kevin Costner's hyper-progressive. I learned this through researching this movie. The last political candidate Kevin Costner endorsed was Pete Buttigieg. I was like fucking shocked. I was absolutely shocked.
Super progressive.
Then. But I expected him to be full John Voight Scott Baio, because he only stars in movies about beating up British Indians and sports. And
I mean, that's the part that I find embarrassing about this movie, because it's directed by Kevin Costner.
Yeah.
And many times that when I find that out about a movie, it kind of gives me heightened scrutiny, basically, on the movie. Because I'm like, okay, you're directing yourself to do some things. Let's see what those things are.
Like, show your own butt.
Yeah. I mean, Kevin Costner is not a good actor. Mm. And there is so much narration voiceover in this
movie. It's so bad.
Sorry, he sounds like a third grader reading a book report.
And remember, he doesn't need a lighting guy or a director of photography to do that VO. Yeah, I like the Indians a lot. It's fun. Kevin, do that again. Do it again. What are you doing? Like,
and then we ran out of rations. And then I went out and I saw a wolf.
There's
and
not a full union crew here. Do it again. What are we doing?
That part is no good. But when he's like standing. Things, that's good. That's good stuff right there.
Yeah. I was shocked at how embarrassing this is not outside of Kevin Costner's performance, and how much I did like it. It is an interesting, I hope it's not in too much of a Green Book-y way, but it has to be fascinating to remember being a colonizing American in this nation of settled people that you can't understand like that. That has to be, I love the way they talk about it. He's like, look, where one white man is coming, more are coming. He's like, I tried to reassure them that that's not the case, but they can see through they know that's not true.
Where like the elder brought out like the helmet of like a conquistador or whatever, and was like, This, you know, we saved this from when my great grandfather had to like defend our lands from these people, and we're going to do it again. You know, that was like really an emotional scene. But I mean, like, I do have to say that there have been few scenes in history that I've seen that have been so affecting as when they're chasing the herd of buffalo.
Oh, yeah.
They come up over the ridge and see what happened to that herd of buffalo. That is,
it's horrible.
Intense scene. So really like gets you right in your feelings, and it really makes you think just about.
And by the way, I'm watching this on a large TV, and like, you don't think of Dances with Wolves as being an effects movie, where like, I'm assuming some of this is a match shot. I used to go buffalo hunting with our vision with my father, and it's, I don't know, I was like, I was sort of bowled over by those sequences. Like, that is, this is beautiful.
Amazing stunt work. I mean, they had to round up like 3,500 buffalo and then stampede them and not get anyone killed.
Kevin Costner, you can see it's not a stunt double, is riding in between two streams of buffalo running at full speed. And I've remembered Tatanka to this day as Super Buffalo because of this film.
It's pretty extraordinary. I mean, this movie is like, walking into watching this movie, I was like, I was telling everyone, fuck, I gotta watch Dances with Wolves this weekend. It's gonna be so long and kind of probably depressing. And
it's preachy. I think the reputation it has now is, oh, it's preachy. Be nice to the Indians. Yeah. And it's like,
it's not at all. Yeah. I feel like the opposite kind of it really does, you know, I think it's I mean, my opinion, whatever. But I mean, I do think it shows like a very like even-handed approach to, not that it's, I'm not both sidesing this, but I'm just saying that like, it's not preachy. It's not overwrought in the ways that I think you might have in your head going into it. And it's definitely like a huge piece of film history that needs to be seen.
Right. It's like, it's, and it has that phenomenon. We talk about, I'm sick of Star Wars when I'm rewatching Star Wars. And like, I feel like your brain tells you the score is cheesy because you've heard all this music before so many times. And like, no, it was made for this moment. It can't be cheesy. This is where it comes from. And Dances with Wolves score is kind of used all over the place. Mm-hmm. So when you hear like the strings kick up, I'm like rolling my eyes, like, oh no, this is an original score for this movie that they ended up stealing and using in a ton of movie trailers throughout the next 10 years.
For the moment. Mm-hmm. So just let yourself feel it. And also I have to say, like, I love Mary McDonnell. Like, she's a great actress.
The president on Battlestar Galactica?
That's the first time I saw her was on Battlestar Galactica. And when I was telling my parents about Battlestar Galactica, they were like, oh yeah, the lady from Dances with Wolves. So that's like a generational thing. That's kind of fun. But, but yeah, she's really good. And I really thought she did a very good job in what could be a very caricature sort of depiction. Mm-hmm. She, I think, tones it down in a way that's more believable. Real tough road to hoe with that role, I feel like.
I got a dope insight from my hairdresser lady that, like, that is how a six-figure salary hairdresser thinks a movie star should look with bad hair.
That hair
and, like, is it's
so enviable.
Yeah.
Like, girl, what vitamins are you taking?
Yeah, I wish I woke up looking like Bon Jovi.
And curled and, yeah, that just distracts the hell out of me that, like, she has like a modern hairstyle instead of, you know, braids like anybody else.
But they're trying to make it look mush. You can even see, like, she even showed me, like, look, they tried to make that one stick up, but it doesn't compensate for how gorgeous the rest of the and how much body the rest of the hair looks.
They try to make it like the hair is almost another character. We're like, one of her girlfriends is like brushing her hair and is like, ooh, girl, that white man is so cute. And she's like, girl, I know, but I feel like because I'm still mourning and I have to be told that I can like move on. They're like, girl, we all think you should be with him.
Yeah, we would all like you to leave. Please go with the white man.
It's like, of course he gets with, you know, the one white lady that's there, but it's like, I mean, her character's interesting and like the first thing she thinks when she sees a white guy is, oh God, they're going to take me away. I don't want to go.
Yeah.
They're going to make me go live with the white people. No, please protect me.
But she's more traumatized by the white man than any of the fucking natives. And
oh, hell yeah. And the second of all, it's like, okay, if she were a native born character, then we're getting into like a whole other stupid fucking trope of she's like the Indian princess who's going to be so sweet and kind.
Oh, God, yes. But story-wise, it makes sense. She is also the interpreter. They have to spend the most time around one another. She is a recent widower. It makes sense. I even got to thinking, like, how many people live in this tribe? Look, there's not a lot of kids. Oh, my God. There's probably not a lot of dating options. I'm just, uh-oh.
This must be true. But this begins, we have one of these in every segment this week, the moment where my film knowledge makes me like something less.
Oh.
Because I realize, oh, shit, that's just blank. And for 30 years now, I've been saying something like Avatar or The Last Samurai with Tom Cruise. It's just Dances with Wolves.
Mm-hmm.
It took me 30 years to notice Dances with Wolves is Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah.
And I apologize.
Yeah. But I think there's a reason why we like those movies. It gives us a chance to explore a culture. I think that's when Europe looks down at us for being uncultured. We don't have access to another language. I have spent 3 times in my life being the sole English speaker somewhere. And just like, fuck it. Let's just go with it. Communicate through nods and hand signals. Yes, thank you. I'll buy that. And it's awesome. It's fucking awesome. And I hope everybody should do that. But Americans lack that experience. It's hard to travel. It is $1,000 for me to go to the next place of non-English speakers from my hometown. It just is. It's not a $50 chunnel ride. jerks. In defense of Americans, but like it is, that's why we go to the cinema. It's stupid that Americans lack that experience, but we do. We cannot visit another culture easily.
Until we get the Hyperloop or whatever the fuck is the thing.
And like, we can't visit another culture without taking a lot of it either. And some, Admittedly, but like, yeah, like if you've never had that opportunity to be the only person of your ilk somewhere, just take it, just do it. I thoroughly recommend it. It's something I aspire to do again someday.
I miss it.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Very important.
Oh yeah, I forgot. Like, we can't even do it. We are banned from traveling as Americans.
I literally cannot leave this room I'm in for 14 days. Guys, I'm on day one.
Well, then I guess, I mean, Dances with Wolves is so full of open spaces, you know, just like Lawrence of Arabia. So
and
makes you feel good.
Through like, through right we that was the area of the country we flew to when my dad took me on this Native American tour through reservations.
Yeah. The I think novel. It's mostly South Dakota and Nebraska they film in.
And Wyoming. And that's the places I got to see. That is an especially beautiful area of the country where I, you know, I would never want to live. But and I hate the way they vote. But it is beautiful to look upon. And it's just interesting to think that this movie is, you know, it was shot 30 years ago in like private property. And that property still looks like that. It's I don't know. I just haven't had the. I haven't been to those places in 20, 25 years. And like to see it on the, I see it on a bigger screen. The second biggest screen I've ever seen Dances with Wolves on in HD felt really good. And I was absolutely shocked by how recommendable I found the movie all in all.
Yep.
And I am not a hater anymore. I am not.
I know. I remember last week I was like, come on, we're going to watch Dances with Wolves. I'm going to rewatch it. And you were like, oh,
no.
Just riding around on a horse.
I'm sure this is evident to everyone, but in case there are people out there who are sensitive to this, there is a lot of animal death in this movie.
Yeah.
Just want to say that.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah. But worth taking in again. Worth revisiting for people who have fond memories of it and only see snide YouTubers kicking in the dick every other week.
Yeah.
Kevin, you can still have your Kevin Costner sucks, but it was an ambitious project. And not unlike Star Wars, it's something no one wanted to see made. And he did and pursued it and made himself independently wealthy forever.
I just don't want my Kevin Costner to have to emote. I prefer him to just be like a cocky, sportsy asshole. And that's because I feel like once we try to get him to do any more emoting than that, we're in dangerous water here.
Mm.
Oh my God, we are going long. God damn, Dances with Wolves. Can I move into my next emotional thing? Are we good?
Yeah.
Are we good on this?
Mm-hmm.
We're moving into television. And I'll try and make this as brief as I can, but it is important to me. 1990 television, the 20th through the 26th of November. On the 21st, we had the special, The Muppets Celebrate Jim Henson. It was not uncommon for the Muppets or Jim Henson to make hour-long specials. But if you can't tell by the title, this is celebrating something in particular. And that is the passing of Jim Henson.
Right.
And if you've never seen this, it opens up with a bunch of Muppets. And... a bunch of Muppets, Fozzie, Lou Zealand, everyone's favorite Scooter, Robin, but no Kermit. And there is a reason for that. And I'll have a little clip here.
Guys, mail call! Mail call! It's a postcard from Kermit.
Oh, a postcard from my Uncle Kermit.
What's it say?
It says, Dear gang, I hope all is well with you. I'm fine, and we'll be back with you soon.
I always miss him when he goes off traveling.
Yeah. More.
I forgot to tell you that the big production number is meant to be a tribute to Jim Henson.
Oh, Jim Henson.
Yeah. Who's Jim Henson?
Well, I don't know.
You know Jim Henson?
So the whole thing is talking about Jim Henson, and in the interstitials, Kermit never appears. And I watched this live, and I remember my parents kind of being more affected than me. How do you debut Kermit again? For the first time after the death of Jim Henson, it's different. It's not just the voice. It's the guy who moved his mouth and hands. And the whole time they talk about the process, the Muppets. And at the very end, they close with the song Jim Henson demanded be played at his funeral. Just one person from, I believe, the Charlie Brown musical. And at the an hour into this documentary, I remember my mom kind of like, what the fuck? Because like everyone's singing together. Big Bird and Elmo come in. The Fraggles come in. And sing the song about how just one person can make a difference. And Kermit has not appeared the whole time. And then all of a sudden he walks in the door and doesn't talk for like a minute. And just looks at his friends. And everyone's like, Kermit, you came back. And it was something, a weird in character and out of character moment to tell you that Kermit's not going anywhere just because Jim Henson did. And it's a weird message to send to kids and adults. Again, I was not phased watching this. My mother was. But this is Kermit's last line at the very end of the special.
Well, that just about brings us down to the end of another one. But before we go, let me thank you for being with us for our tribute to Jim Henson. And we'll be seeing you soon with more Muppet stuff, because that's the way the boss would want it.
Steve Whitmer debuting his voice, and it's weirdly modulated in this.
It's not quite right.
But you can find this all on YouTube. And shit, I guess I have to keep talking because of what's in the notes. I really wanted a break after my emotional moment, but I can't, because the WWF is making perhaps one of the most notable debuts in wrestling, excuse me, sports entertainment history.
Weighing in at 320 pounds from Death Valley, I give you The Undertaker.
The Undertaker, the mystery partner, is now revealed.
I never heard of
him. Oh, take him.
That's the debut of The Undertaker. It is just so special for so many reasons. he's fighting in a ring with the Million Dollar Man and the Honky Tonk Man, who's a guy who dresses like Elvis, Bret the Hitman Hart. But this is sort of one of the first major characters that, like, no, it's like, he's a master of death. Is he alive or dead? And then what we get is a story that unfolds in public and on camera for the next 30 years. The Undertaker has almost officially retired at this point, but he has, the real life Mark Calloway has not really broken character that often. His character predominantly doesn't speak. So people lose their minds because this is a storyline that has unfolded in real time for wrestling fans without a break for 30 years.
I mean, isn't that the dream, to play a character who never speaks?
I think it's got to be pretty tough, but I love whenever you see people find Mark Calloway in public, they just yell, "Thank you, Taker," because commitment to the job. And if you don't know The Undertaker behind the scenes, he's also pretty morale boosting guy in the locker room. Kind of keeps everyone together. So that's why he's been so in sync with the company for 30 years. I've seen like 3 Undertaker retirement matches, so that's why I'm unclear, and I believe he's wrestling soon. But I saw him officially retire. It's complicated. Here's a show I've never heard of.
Actually, a TV movie.
Oh, TV movie.
Yeah.
I have to see this. I've seen everything George Carlin has ever been in. And at the time, I would watch anything Ben Stiller was in.
So this is a TV movie for Fox, starring George Carlin and Ben Stiller playing 2 janitors who work at like a finance company, and kind of in the course of like taking out the trash, find some like, I don't know, trade secrets or something that they can use to get rich. I don't understand stuff, and money isn't real. So like, you guys figure it out.
I got a real hot tip from the garbage.
That makes sense why it's called Working Trash.
Working Trash.
Two Wall Street janitors are about to discover the secret to success is in the can.
Garbage like that you come across once in a lifetime.
Now they're turning a little trash,
we'd like to make an investment,
into a lot of cash.
You bought a bottle with a cork?
No screw tops tonight, Ruthie.
And giving Wall Street a kick in the assets.
Where are those morons getting their money?
George Carlin.
Trash will really always be my first love.
Working Trash.
I have got to see this.
Yeah, man.
I've got
Ben
to see
Stiller
this.
Not big enough to get his name mentioned.
I know, right?
What has he done? He pops up. He's like 18 or 19, and he pops up in Empire of the Sun.
Empire of the Sun and the Ben Stiller Show. I think. Oh, no, Ben Stiller
Show's
not
hasn't
on.
Hasn't started yet, man.
Wow, you're right. That is about it. Maybe that stint on SNL where he quit or was allowed to be fired. I track down Working Trash with a dollar sign in its title. Otherwise, put that in there. You won't find it. Books of 1990. Iron John hits the New York Times bestseller list. What is Iron John?
This is a super weird thing. It's a nonfiction book by poet Robert Bly, and it's a sort of close reading of a parable, a German parable, Brothers Grimm, where about like a boy maturing into adulthood through like going into the forest and finding himself. And it became this sort of cultural phenomenon. The idea of the book is that American men are too feminized these days.
Oh no, they'll be wearing dresses any minute now.
Right, and looking hot as fuck. Hello, Harry Styles. So therefore, like, men need to like go out into the wilderness and refine their manhood and reclaim their masculinity. And it kind of became like a little sort of like cultural phenomenon that like they would have retreats, Iron John retreats, where like men would like go out into the forest together and like, I don't know,
hug and howl at the moon. Ow!
Yeah, it's very interesting just to kind of see that in the context of like the discourse of literally the past couple of days about American masculinity and where it's going and it's in danger. Da, da, da. I mean, talk about things that aren't real, like gender isn't real. It's just, I just thought it was an interesting thing to bring up that I don't think a lot of people have ever heard of, but is was definitely like a little niche culture thing.
I hear the word Iron John and all I can think about is a cold hiney. Am I? That's where I would have thrown to Paul Schaefer.
See, it was on the New York Times bestseller list for more than a year.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I actually remember some of my uncles talking about it when I was like a kid, you know, you're like just hanging out in the kitchen and, you know, whatever, adults are talking about things. And so, yeah, it even reached North Florida. But yeah, it's definitely kind of, I mean, it's interesting that like 30 years later, we're still talking about the problem of masculinity and like what's happened to it.
Dude, wear what you want. I bet going commando under a dress is really comfortable.
I was when watching Dances with Wolves, I'm like, that is the longest fucking zipper I've ever seen. And I just got real confused. Like, why did men not get the dress? And it should be reversed. You should have the pressed up part up against your pelvis, and we should have the thing that flows in the dress. It's so unfair. It's
agreed. And also, other cultures in the world besides America have figured that out. Hello, the fact.
It stinks, and I hate it. God damn it.
I'm wearing a dress right now.
I'm definitely going to remove these 4-day unwashed jeggings because they're starting to stick to my skin. If I can dumb it down a little bit with games, and I'm going to try and keep it brief because this is an incredibly, incredibly important day, but it is more important for Japan. And we made a decision a long time ago. We will bring up Japanese releases, but we find it a little more important. But just to note their anniversary, but our experiences are when they happen, which for Americans is not now. But the Super Nintendo debuts in Japan this week. And we'll talk about the launch experience for Americans probably a lot on patreon.com/lasertime with hopefully Chris Baker again, the Video Game Apocalypse crew. But this is, for all intents and purposes, the 30th anniversary of Captain Falcon and Yoshi. Yoshi debuts 30 years ago. Yep, Yoshi and Falcon Punch! I think people only know him from Smash Brothers at this point. Both of them are in Smash Brothers. Both of them have amiibos. Happy anniversary to them and all the other characters from F-Zero and Super Mario World. Super Mario 4 is what it's called in Japan. Let's close out with a little talk about music in 1990, November 20th to the 26th. Love Takes Time by Mariah Carey is still number one, but we do have some new releases, such as Heartbreak Station by Cinderella, the weirdest name for like a macho metal band I've ever heard. Against the Grain by Bad Religion, Pills and Thrills and Bellyaches by Happy Mondays, and the self-titled debut of Ralph Tresvant? I don't know this person.
Close enough.
We're going to close out this segment, this long segment. Thanks, Kevin Costner, for spreading your fucking lack of editing to our podcast.
Seriously, stay away from the 4-hour cut. There is nothing new or interesting in there. They made very smart decisions cutting it down to 3 hours.
Yeah. And, but we're going to close out with Step On by Happy Mondays, and we'll see you once again in 2000. Rhymes rugged and built like Schwarzenegger, and I'ma get mad deep like a threat. Blow up your project, then take all your assets, cause I came to shake the frame in half with the thoughts that bomb shit like math. So if you wanna try to flip, yo, flip on the next man, cause I'll grab the clip and coming into 2000 with Protect Your Neck by Wu-Tang Clan off of their third album, The W. Follow up. I kind of fell off the Wu-Tang at this point, but man, that was that shook our world. Wu-Tang Clan. It not only created a soundtrack to like my entire teenage years, it got everyone rightfully obsessed with Kung Fu movies, and it was a wonderful time. Thank you, Wu-Tang. Thank you, RZA, and the rest. Welcome to 2000, everyone. New music releases this week also include Black and Blue by the Backstreet Boys, Checkmate by BG, A Day Without Rain by Enya, Mama's Gun by Erykah Badu, The New Pornographer's debut, Mass Romantic, The Reunion by Capone and Noriega, The Songs for an American Movie, Volume 2, Good Time for a Bad Attitude by Everclear. Independent Woman Part 1 by Destiny's Child is number 1 on the charts. Whew! 2000, everyone. November 20th through the 26th. If you remember what life was like 20 years ago, I still say this 20 years ago, this should be a scarier situation electorally, but not yet. I mean, I guess I'm not a Trump supporter, so I'm not freaking out. But in the 2000 election, the recount continues at this point. There is still... there's not even a declared winner at this point.
Nope.
The world is cursed to know Florida Secretary of State Catherine Harris played almost cruelly in that movie by Laura Dern.
Yeah.
God. Oh,
yeah.
When I saw her dressed up, I'm like, oh my God, that is mean. That is so mean. Bush's state campaign chairwoman, who's in charge of the recount, she refuses updated info from counties and certifies the vote. So everybody goes to court and... You know, eventually Al Gore rolls over.
Eventually.
It's
going to take a while.
Yeah. And if you haven't heard the show before, that made the sleepy little capital town I was born and raised in, Tallahassee, Florida, this hotbed of news. I couldn't get to school through all the traffic and CNN helicopters. And my friends made a pretty regular thing of dressing up and ruining news shots, and you can still see some of them on YouTube. Well, let's go ahead and get into the movies of 2000, November 20th through the 26th. How the Grinch Stole Christmas is still number one at the box office. I'll report back to you people, but I am going to watch that again with a fresh eyes. We've had a discussion with my lady friend, and she loves this movie, so I'm going to have to learn to love it too somehow. So there. And but a movie I refuse to learn to love, because this is this the first Disney live action remake? I guess the one they like poured a ton of resources into that wasn't live straight for television.
Sequel.
A remake
sequel. I believe it's the first of those.
But it also, like, the 101 Dalmatians with Glenn Close as Cruella de Vil, fucking unbelievable casting. Like, that alone is interesting to watch.
Okay. Amen. I'll give you that one.
One of the best Disney villains ever. And by the way, I just had a cup of hot cocoa out of my 101 Dalmatians mug. A lot of Christmas scenery in 101 Dalmatians. Don't sleep on it. It's I think the first Disney movie with a car and a television in it, because it's set in the modern day. But this is the sequel to the live action remake, which... I get sick to my stomach the longer that sentence gets, but Glenn Close, Ian Gruffand, Alice Evans, Tom McInerney, and Gerard Depardieu in 102 Dalmatians.
The Dalmatians are back. For a brand new tale. Starring Oddball.
Hey!
And Waddlesworth.
Oddball's got no underwear.
Glenn Close.
Oh, tastes like chicken.
Disney's 102 Dalmatians, rated G. Starts.
Oh no, no thank you. But I can't reiterate, like, this is a Disney movie made in the 60s, and all of a sudden in the 2000s, there's an animated series of 101 Dalmatians, there's video games. This live-action remake really revitalized that brand in a way I can't really get behind, but if you're a little younger than me, the Dalmatians were everywhere. Toys. Mm-hmm. Games,
this
movies.
This is true. I mean, it's a bad sign that basically no one is back from the original cast. The first movie, except for Glenn Close. Going for it.
Gerard Depardieu wasn't one of the henchmen in the first one? I can't remember.
I believe he is the furrier this time. He's
okay.
He might be in the original, but just a little bit. Yeah. No, I mean, these are turning into snow buddies. You know, it's just... It's just cute dogs, and they do cute things, and then every now and then Glenn Close shows up in a completely fantastic costume and yells. Yeah, whatever.
Is this a situation where, like, the dogs are CGI'd to have their mouths be talking, or no?
You know what? I don't remember, because they have voices here, because they, you know, they talked in the movie, in the original movie. This didn't really do anything for me, so... I don't know.
This is for little kids, and I'm sure it's fine.
Even
for
though
them,
fucking fine. What critic is this saying? Like, it's a little boring and also a little too violent for a G-rated movie. I'm like, now I'm interested.
Oh, boring and violent is not a good combination.
with Frankie Muniz as the voice of the dog Domino, at least in the video game. This is just a brief glance of the wiki. But this is the movie I'm more excited to talk about.
Because
I rewatched it recently and it held up pretty well up until, and once again, like 102 Dalmatians. Then you see the sequel. Spencer Treat Clark, Robin Wright Penn, Samuel L. Jackson, Bruce Willis in Unbreakable.
Why are you looking at me like that?
One, because it seems you are the only survivor of this train wreck. And two, you don't have a scratch on you.
I've come to believe the rather unbelievable possibility. I hope you can keep an open mind.
Unbreakable.
Yeah, it's. I think we talked about it maybe with Sarah on a bonus time watching this before. What was the fucking Glass? It was called Glass, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there's Split and then there's Glass.
Split is a little slice of wonderful. Glass is just, wow, holy shit, this is bad.
So bad, it made me angry, like, in the movie. I think I actually walked out the last 10 minutes, I feel like.
Yeah, I remember we saw it with your stepson, and I'd never seen, like, a polite preteen, like, I thought it was pretty okay. He's like, he's trying to put a nice spin on this for the adults who look very disappointed.
It had so many problems. It was a little bit fun to watch Glass. I watched it with Unbreakable as a double feature. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of fun because there's like scenes that were deleted from Unbreakable that show up in Glass. And Spencer Treat Clark is back. The kid is back. It's been like 20 years. Yeah. And that's kind of cool. Let's talk about Unbreakable. Obviously, M. Night Shyamalan's follow-up to The Sixth Sense, which is where that's a very precarious place to be in your career, to have a massive hit and to follow it up. And this did well. It was, you know, critics liked it. It obviously was not as massive a hit, but it's also weirder and nichier at a time where we did not have a lot of comic book movies. It's a comic book movie.
That's what I find the most fascinating about it. I always find it fascinating to see what movies Hollywood makes before it really got on board with allowing superhero movies to exist. They're expensive to license and they're too silly. Audiences won't accept this. Half this movie is about, like, what if superheroes were real? The kind of thing, like, if you think of what we last did with the Avengers and Endgame involving spaceships, time travel, organic suits, nobody has a mask, everybody's face is just covered with nanometal. None of that requires explanation. And when you watch Unbreakable, there are a couple scenes like, you don't have to you don't talk me into a superhero movie, man. I'm already here. I believe.
Yeah. They walk you through in a very practical sort of way of him realizing I'm the only survivor of this horrible train accident, not a scratch on me, and realizing I've never been sick.
I've never broken a bone.
I've never broken a bone. Mm-hmm. All right, let's see how much I can bench. I can bench everything. this is weird.
And those sequences are the best because he has no one else to confide in but his young son. So he's just
done so well, too, because like this is my favorite, I think, of the Shyamalan's, even more than Sixth Sense, just because it is quieter, it's weirder. I think it's more menacing and more scary in a lot of ways. And it is like, when you say it like, oh, this guy's like never been hurt, never been sick, is like super strong, and nobody's ever figured out like, oh, there's something weird about that. It's actually played really well by Bruce Willis because he plays it in such like a quiet, unassuming guy sort of role that like, why would he ever be tested? You know, like he's just kind of plays it like an everyman. So like, yeah, it makes sense that he's like never really thought about the fact that he's never been really sick or really hurt or anything like that. I don't know. The way it's like scripted out is very believable.
It's one of the weirdly one of the least cliche ridden superhero movies or origin stories there is. His character's so quiet. He never has that moment like, whoa, cool, look at what I can do. He's just fucking quiet about everything. Like, this is probably going to suck for me. I'm just going to keep my mouth shut.
I already got problems. Yeah. You know, I got a job. I'm breaking up with my wife, it seems like, or trying to figure things out. And I don't need this kind of Mishigas in my life.
and you're right. A much quiet, because I am actually, I like Signs a lot.
I like Signs too.
And I do like Sixth Sense a lot, but this is weirdly my favorite because it is, there's a subtlety to it. There's still like a student independent filmy thing to it. Like, that's a really long scene to shoot from in between chairs. And
okay, that's where I was talking about, like, feeling cursed by knowing older movies too well. Mm-hmm. The one thing that really distracted me this time is intentionally showy camera work.
Yep.
And sometimes it's very intentionally showy, and sometimes I'm like, that shot's from Lady from Shanghai.
Right.
That shot's from Strangers on a Train.
Hitchcockian.
Bitch,
all the way.
Bitch, I've been to film school. Stop it.
And it's
you
like,
stop that right now. It's not necessary, as a lot of times it's sort of like, see, look, Daddy, I can do it. I'm mm-hmm. the new Spielberg, Daddy. Stop it. That shot did not require that.
Yeah, but that sequence where he finally like tries to do something, realize, oh, I can feel premonitions and I'm indestructible, and it's like made to look like one single shot. It's fucking nice.
Yeah.
It's a nice original sequence, but I know exactly what you're talking about with like, this is referencing something. And I'm cringing, but I do deep down appreciate that it's being done.
Well, I mean, it's kind of indicative of M. Night Shyamalan's like whole deal is that like his swings are like really great or really bad. There's not a ton of like just that was fine in there in his oeuvre. It's just like either great, fantastic, or pretty dreadful.
That's how I used to describe my joke delivery on this show. I swing a lot and really hard, and I miss frequently. But oh man, every once in a while when you connect, you get a splitter and Unbreakable.
Feels really good. Most of the only thing about Unbreakable that still sticks in my craw is that, okay, the whole thing where Samuel Jackson is explaining like their weaknesses and their strengths or whatever, and he's like, we have the same weakness, water. Mm-hmm. But it's like, but you also have the weakness of like your bones breaking all the time, like no matter what. Yeah,
it's not clear about what your superpower is. You think you're the smartest man alive because you've read a ton of comics. But the movie doesn't really show us that. And I think Glass sort of tries to reinforce that with more clever planning on his part.
Yeah.
But yeah, his superpower isn't clear. And you can even read it as like, oh, you're a delusional crazy person.
But,
but nowhere near on the special level of Bruce Willis. But if not for Glass, none of this would have been driven forward in any way. As it's
It's just like, I think overall it's still a really great movie. It does exactly what it needs to be. But I wish that, you know, maybe instead of telling us how smart he is because he's like read all these comic books or whatever, maybe make him a little bit more of like a charismatic, manipulative guy. Mm-hmm. I feel like that would have been even better character foil to Bruce Willis, who's like a very quiet, unassuming, like everyday guy,
trusted
but
man.
Very strong physically. Like, I'm giving him night at this point. But like,
I was thinking that too. It's like, I really like it until they basically announce the whole point at the end. I got it. No, I understand.
Sometimes they're best friends.
Yeah, I understand what you've been, this whole time you've been quietly doing an origin story for a superhero, and every superhero has a villain. Gotcha. Mm-hmm. You didn't need to yell it at me. I understood.
I made a self-fulfilling prophecy, John. Where are you going?
Yeah. You know, overall, I mean, it held up really well, except for how destructive and good child acting again from Spencer Tree Clark.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
And it does say something about the storytelling where, like, I feel like what we're talking about here about, like, the whole mashup of, like, the good guy versus the bad guy doesn't exactly work. It's still not a fatal flaw to this movie. It still is a really good movie, even though we are having, like, there is some quibbles.
And I forget there was, this is an M. Night Shyamalan's like, I can do whatever I want phase. He shot the movie sequentially, and I think tried to allow the actors to learn of these things as they shot things. I'm not sure if that's exactly the case, but it was shot sequentially, which is, as I get older, just like, what a terrible waste of money.
Yeah, it's really not something you should do.
Yeah, what a terrible waste of money.
But when you've got a ton of extras and you're at a stadium, you shoot all your shit that's supposed to be at the stadium with a ton of extras.
Yeah. But the only thing I think that puts a damper on this at all is A, Glass, and B, just a mild young director pretension. But it's good pretension.
It's fine though. I mean, it still overcomes all of that. I think overall we get like a really good movie. And I have to say, like, one of the things that's really stuck with me with this film and like imagery that I keep often going back to in my head is towards the end where the family is like being held in their house by these bad guys. And then Bruce Willis is like coming in trying to save them, but then he falls in the pool. All of that is extremely dark and extremely scary, like indelible, basically. And I thought that was done so well. It's not often something like that sticks with you for that long.
Yeah, I think most people would hold this aloft as M. Night Shyamalan's greatest film, and I could get on. I would like to have a hotter take, but that's probably true.
Yeah, I mean, Sixth Sense, I think, just edges it out because I feel like he's being less showy. The showiness, when there is showiness, it has more impact, and here he does showy things at places where it doesn't have an impact, but sometimes it's really good, like the great scene at the 30th Street Station. Again, Billy! Where he realizes, like, because all of his powers are things you wouldn't notice. It's not like he shoots lasers out of his eyes. Mm-hmm. And he realizes, like, he has this weird intuition to see what bad things people have done. And he's, like, tests it out. Just starts randomly bumping into people in a train station and seeing, like, oh, that lady stole something. Oh, that guy kind of date raped a unconscious girl. Mm-hmm. And, oh, that guy's a full-on psychopath. I'm going to go follow him.
I wonder was the person he walked by just happened to be thinking about the worst thing they ever did, and as he breezed them, or I don't know, does he have some moral filter?
That is something that I have found myself thinking about every now and then, like when I'm in a huge group of people. It would always happen when I would be at like football stadiums and like a huge group of people, just thinking to myself, how many people here have murdered someone?
Knowing what football stadium,
statistically,
I mean,
knowing what football stadium you're in, it's probably just a bunch of people yelling in unison, I paid too little on my taxes.
But then rounding things up, just like Predator, it took us 17 years to get another one. It took us 16 years to get Split, which only in the last scene we find out, oh, they're related.
Yeah.
Then we go to Glass, which has a couple okay parts overall.
I can't believe how silly.
Needed another couple drafts, my man.
Yeah, that ending is terrible. It's one of the worst endings I've ever seen in my life.
It's dumb to
intentionally build up to nothing. Like, there's no catharsis here. This wasn't thematic. This didn't matter. You just didn't write anything. Fuck off. Fuck off. But yeah, go see Glass, I guess. But Unbreakable, a great rewatch.
He's a hero, damn it.
I can't not Kimmy Schmidt it every time I hear the word now. In 2000, we get the finale after five seasons of the Chris Rock Show. And I don't know. I never hear him talk about it, which makes me wonder if there's animosity. I get the feeling like he didn't need to host a weekly talk show and could probably make more money in movies and doing stand-up. He was that prolific as a stand-up. But it's weird when I think about what we got out of the Chris Rock Show, because the only thing that will happen after this is if you like comedy, Wanda Sykes becomes a household name, and she's basically given a platform on the show from the beginning. I was even looking up famous quotes and her defending Hillary Clinton, like, if I'm the first lady, I shouldn't have to suck anybody's dick. And she wouldn't. Because she was still going by Wanda Sykes Hall at that point, her hyphenate of her ex-husband. And we get Pootie Tang, eventually, the Louis C.K. written and directed movie that is technically a spinoff of the Chris Rock Show. And I mention this because I watched it every week. I loved it. It is nowhere. It is unstreamable. It has the first two seasons on DVD, which, you know, for a talk show is reasonable. Not a lot of talk shows are completely on DVD, but this wasn't really that. It was a lot less topical and a lot of sketches.
More of a sketch show with an occasional interview. I found the first two seasons, I think, are on Amazon to rent, and they're like $2 an episode, which is some hot bullshit. and then there's like a bunch of stuff just sort of randomly on YouTube. And it's super unfair because there's some really, really good sketches.
They really are. And I love seeing, I said this before, but occasionally a Chris Rock sketch will pop up and no one knows what it's from because it'll have Chris Rock in it and like how to survive being pulled over by the police or something like that. Some of those things become more relevant as time goes on and you just don't know what they're from. Chris Rock Show. And that is about it. Is that it for television? Oh man, what a light week.
Yeah. Well, 2010 is going to be really thick with stuff. So it's nice to have at least one segment that's a little shorter.
In video games, we will do so very much more of that over on patreon.com/lasertime. But you should know what came out between the 20th and the 26th, because it is all important, including 007 Racing. All the cool cars. Yeah, all the cool cars. I mean, after GoldenEye, James Bond became a valuable video game franchise. It almost never recaptured that magic, but its name became synonymous with great games. Banjo-Tooie is out on Nintendo 64. That is one of the best worst name sequels I've ever heard. Instead of calling it Banjo-Kazooie 2, it's Banjo-Tooie. Batman Beyond Return of the Joker is on PS1. Dave Mira Freestyle BMX hits Dreamcast. Mech Warrior 4 Vengeance. Star Trek Deep Space Nine The Fallen hits PC, I think. And that is about it for that week. Again, we'll go way more in depth. I love digging into lately the arcade games that came out during this period, because they don't have a lot of concrete release dates, but we try and refine that for the Patreon show with the Vigigame Apocalypse Boys and Chris Baker. If he'll still have us. He's been really, really good to us. Thank you, Chris, if you're listening. Let's head out of 2000 with Only Time by Enya. This is what...
Yeah.
Wow!
It's the 20th anniversary of this, the music you use when you're relaxing in a bathtub. If you're going to cut away to someone relaxing.
If you're Adam McKay, this is your favorite song.
I mean, this is, you know, I think
you're in a commercial and you're eating cookies away from the kids.
Yeah. I believe it's
or you're Will Ferrell doing some sort of graceful thing you wouldn't think Will Ferrell could do. That's really what we're talking about here.
I think it's full blown TikTok-y meme at this point. This song, and if you don't know what it is, now you do.
Not mad about it, dude. She lives in a castle.
She does. I don't know anything about Enya. I've never heard him or her or they talk. I don't know.
Why would you need to?
I guess.
She lives in a castle. It's fine.
It's one of the greatest reasons I love L.A. Story. It's got like a mostly Enya soundtrack for some reason.
Her parents set her for life.
Yeah. all right, we'll close out with that. I don't want to get all Lord of the Ringsy on this. We'll close out with some Enya. Stay right there, people. 2010. Oh, man, some super fun stuff to talk about. Stay right there.
And all the ships at sea, it's time for Diana's Classic Corner. We go even further back in time this week to see if there's anything worth a watching. And for the week of November 20th through 26th, let's talk about fascism, everybody! Let's start with 75 years ago this week, 1945. The Nuremberg Trials began, dealing with the genocide and crimes against humanity by the Nazis, which, man, they moved on that pretty fast because the war in Europe only ended the previous April. So, yeah, I feel obligated to recommend Judgment at Nuremberg from 1961, which is it's a pretty solid trial movie. I mean, it's Spencer Tracy is always good. Maximilian Schell is really good in it. You know, it's what you think it is. It's about the trials and how do you separate out, like, who's following orders and at what point should they refuse those orders and what would the punishment be for refusing orders. And, yeah, you know, solid classic Hollywood kind of good guys and bad guys kind of trial story. And then moving forward, it's also this week the 50th anniversary of the very strange death of Japanese author Yukio Mishima, who's 45. I dug more into the story and everything I hit got weirder and weirder. Like, I've read some of Mishima's short stories and they're beautiful. I wish I could read them in the original Japanese because just the translations are they're very, very poetic and strange and interesting. But he formed his own nationalist militia. And in 1970, he and a couple of his bros tried to overthrow the Japanese government by holding a general hostage and then recruiting all the soldiers to join them to restore the emperor to his god status. It didn't go well because here's a little tip, no matter what your politics, if your plan involves, and then the people rise up to join us, it's not gonna work. So it did not work out for him. And then he committed suicide ritualistically. I'm kind of bummed because there is a movie about this. I'm going to talk about that in a second. But I'm kind of bummed that, like, it seems like so much of this, because he wrote about ritual suicide so much that, like, this was his end game. He just wanted a big stage maybe to kill himself. And it turned out it didn't go the way of the samurai that he wanted. He botched it. His second botched it, where they're supposed to cut your head off. And he, like, fucked it up. And it sounds like slapstick gory nonsense went on. And in some ways, it's even more fitting end than just the, like, I'm going to commit seppuku and I'm dying at my best. But the film I'm going to recommend about this, which does not cover the horrible slapsticky gross end, is Mishima, A Life in Four Chapters from 1985, which is directed by Paul Schrader, who's probably best known for writing Taxi Driver, but he also did First Reformed the other year. Mishima, A Life in Four Chapters is a difficult movie because it's a biopic, but it also intercuts these stagings of parts of his books that are very artistic. They're like on this kind of weird stage, and I don't know, it's kind of surreal. It's a slow movie. It's mostly known for its Philip Glass score. I think it's more famous than the rest of the movie. But if you're into artsy stuff, I would definitely check it out. It's on Criterion Channel right now. So yeah, those are my two recommendations to post-World War II fascism and its consequences movies, A Judgment at Nuremberg and Mishima, Life in Four Chapters. And that's for this week. Stay classic.
Coming in at 2010 with What's My Name by Rihanna featuring Drizzy.
What's my name?
Featuring Drake. It's number one this week. Welcome to 2010 with little Rihanna and Drake. We also have some new releases and other music. Danger Days, The True Lives of the Fabulous Killjoys by the My Chemical Romance. Pink Friday by Nicki Minaj. Body Talk by Robin, The Beginning by the Black Eyed Peas. And Kanye West's My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy, which is on Rolling Stone's top 500 albums of all time list.
Big week.
This is huge. Oh my goodness. Pink Friday by Nicki Minaj. Nicki Minaj is one of, it's kind of a perfect album. I mean, almost every song on there is great. Like, and you can listen through the whole album and there's really no misses there. Body Talk by Robin is a album that I have on repeat all the time. I mean, this is where we get Call Your Girlfriend. This is where we get Dancing on Your Own, or On My Own, sorry. This is where we get Hang With Me. I mean, these are like huge, huge hits.
Yeah.
Really, really good album.
Like, it's almost like the pinnacle of dance pop.
Yeah.
My only problem is I had never heard Call Your Girlfriend for a really long time, and then I did hear it, and I'm like, that's Isn't She Lovely by Stevie Wonder. Y'all are ripping off Stevie Wonder. I am cursed with knowledge!
I prefer Call Your Girlfriend, I'm sorry.
Isn't She Lovely, man? Yeah. It is.
Also, I mean, My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy is humongous. And it's not my favorite Kanye West. I actually do prefer College Dropout. But is this where we really see his, like, turn into the more, like, artsy stuff that he...
Yeah.
I mean, this is, like, really where we start to kind of see, oh, shit, this dude's weird. This is fun in, like, a very weird way. Yeah. And then he takes another turn into even weirder, which in the most recent years, which, you know, whatever. But, it's cool. It's very cool.
Yeah. This is another one of those where it's like, I feel bad I haven't listened to this, and then I listen to it, and I'm like, well, damn. Okay. I don't know if this is going on like my constant repeat list because it's so different from everything else I listen to. But I was like, I appreciate this. This is freaking art.
Oh, yeah. High recommend of Pink Friday, Body Talk, and My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy as albums that you should listen to all the way through a couple times each because they just get better and better.
Yeah. A little bit of news to bring you into the magic of 2010. 10 years ago, I know Sarah put this here. The second annual Never Not Funny podcast, the Podcastathon, raises $26,000 for, is it Smile something?
Smile Train. It's a charity that raises money to go to developing countries and fix children who have cleft palates. And yeah, I mean, Never Not Funny is a podcast that I have listened to from the very, very beginning. And you know, after a while, they started a podcastathon, which originally was 12 hours of podcasting nonstop with like guests and musical interludes. And it's pretty much, it's a pretty astounding feat of podcasting, especially now that I'm done podcasting a little bit. Mm-hmm. I can tell you, like, damn, thinking about doing that for 12 hours straight is wild. and still doing it. And I think this year they took it. I'm actually behind on my Never Not Funny listening, but I do think, of course, they had to take it online this year. They've, in the past couple of years, they've raised hundreds of thousands of dollars for Smile Train.
Well,
which is pretty fantastic. And I mean, Jimmy Pardo is one of the best comedians in the business and probably one of the best guys in the business. Just one of my favorite all-time dudes. So I love to see that news.
Movies of 2010, November 20th through the 26th. Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1 is still number one at the box office. Again, one of the few times I finished our podcast and just ran upstairs and watched the movie we just talked about. I enjoyed it much, much more after our discussion. And man, I cannot wait to get to part two. I don't know how much have we discussed this, and this, because this reminded me of an argument I had with Matt recently. He like called something, it's like if Hugo didn't suck. I'm like, bitch, hey, what did you just say? Hugo sucks. And I was like, what do you like about Hugo? I'm like, I think Hugo's the best experience I've had in a 3D movie. And where I don't know if we touched on that, like, this is the fourth renaissance of 3D films. We are in the middle of it. And that included something I know a lot of people were excited for. The Nutcracker 3D came out with Elle Fanning, Nathan Lane, and John Turturro. Is that a Disney joint?
I'm not sure it is a Disney joint. Mm-hmm. I want to say yes, but I could be wrong there. But I know it is a non-ballet joint, and it has the distinction of having a zero on Rotten Tomatoes.
Wow.
I mean, if it's not ballet, I want nothing with it.
Yeah, why wouldn't you have ballet?
No.
I have a love-hate relationship with the Nutcracker. I mean, growing
you're a dancer, everyone. I'm sure you all do.
Exactly. So
it's not a Disney joint.
I love it, the thing that exists. I've loved iterations of it, but not all iterations are created equal. It's got to be real, real good to get me to watch it.
I was guessing, like, this is a public domain movie. Anybody could make it. And then I look at one of the production companies behind this film, Nutcracker Holdings.
Nutcracker Holdings?
Yeah, why romanticize it? That's all I do is pimp the Nutcracker in any fucking medium I can all week. Coming soon to the Oculus.
Is it Tchaikovsky's family?
I have no idea. Nutcracker Holdings. Maybe they're the people who own the patent on those actual, like, fucking walnut-breaking soldiers. Nutcracker Holdings. And, tons of movies out this week, so we didn't get to all of them. Lenin Naked with Christopher Eccleston, Andrew Scott, and Naoko Mori is out this week.
Let's blow through some of these real fast. So Lenin Naked is a John Lennon biopic, more about after the Beatles. Reviews are pretty much it's for Beatles completists only, which is a bummer, but Lennon, I just wanted to point out.
Isn't it Lennon's biggest asshole period?
Yeah, it's Lennon's asshole period.
Yeah, I hate John Lennon. I think he's a huge asshole, and I don't like that he's so revered. And it makes me sad that Hot Priest is in this.
I wanted to point out, that's pretty much why I left it in here, because it was made for TV in the UK. Christopher Eccleston, so the first of the new Doctor Who's, plays John Lennon, and Hot Priest plays Paul McCartney.
That's the only one that got me to watch this, considering how much I hate John Lennon.
Yeah, well, maybe you'll find different reasons to hate him. I don't know.
Who put the bug up her ass? London Boulevard with Colin Farrell, Keira Knightley, and Ray Winstone. What is this?
All right, so we have London Boulevard, and also Faster with Dwayne Johnson, Moon Bloodgood, I'm positive that's not her name, Billy Bob Thornton, and Carla Gugino. I'm going to lump them together because they both got, like, reviews, and they're both about a criminal coming out of prison, and then they pull him back in. And yeah, every review is sort of like, well, you know, what do you want? It's expect most London Boulevard got better reviews. It's, you know, hard-boiled British. Obviously, Ray Winstone is there. And most people were just like, Faster with Dwayne Johnson, it's not fast enough. Like, that's a terrible title for a movie that's actually kind of boring.
Well, it's also extremely confusing because at first I thought this was part of the Fast franchise. Yeah. And then I did watch like the first 40, 45 minutes of this movie, and it is terrible. It's just no, there's just nothing. Like, it's just boring.
Yeah.
Nonsensical.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's I love The Rock more than most people, and that's kind of... He's got a 50% ratio. This movie could be great or the worst thing you've ever fucking seen. It's why he makes the most money of any other actor. He does 17 movies a year. Some aren't good.
It took him a little while, I feel like, to work his way up on quality.
Mm-hmm. And now for the movies we'll spend more time talking about. Wow, look at this cast. Hank Azaria, Oliver Platt, Gabrielle Macht, Judy Greer, Anne Hathaway, Jake Gyllenhaal, Love and Other Drugs. Ugh.
You're nervous.
Why would I be nervous?
Because you're interested.
You're good. Tell me what you want to I'm sorry, it's so late.
Oh my god.
Oh my god.
Oh my god.
Get out!
I need someone to take care of you.
I can't ask you to do that.
You didn't. You meet thousands of people. And then you meet one person. And your life has changed forever.
Love and Other Drugs. Wait.
Buzz and barf.
This looks insufferable. Wretch.
Put me in a very bad mood.
This kind of movie I can't fucking stand. And then I watched it anyway because I love you. And I liked it a lot more than I thought I would.
Oh, really?
Wow.
Because there are some quality jokes in there. Much more R-rated jokes than you usually see from, because I mean they're selling it as like it's a sweet November or love story, you know, or it's tight-laced business guy meets manic pixie dream girl, but and he finds love and life again, but cough cough, oh no, she's sick, and oh, we've learned that love conquers all or some shit, and it's part that but part no strings attached.
Yeah, it's like Josh Gad is also in this, and like. So I saw this movie when it came out in theaters because I was going through a very sad, very transitional time in my life at this particular time 10 years ago. And I remember thinking, like, this movie did not do what I needed it to do, which is, like, cheer me up in a rom-com sense. But I didn't really remember why. I just remember having that vibe, like, now, 10 years ago. So I was like, let me watch it again and see, like, what I remember from it. And this movie put me in such a bad mood because everyone in this movie is a fucking asshole. And not even like an anti-hero, like, you know, Jack Nicholson in As Good As It Gets, sort of like asshole with a heart of gold. They're just fucking assholes. So the story is that Jake Gyllenhaal is a pharmaceutical rep, one of the worst professions.
Which they make it very clear that is a horrible profession.
Yes.
Full of assholes. It only exists for assholes.
Anne Hathaway is a very young woman, 26-year-old, who has Parkinson's. And through a series of highly illegal and unethical ways, Paul sees her in a doctor's office and then procures her information and starts dating her. Like, totally glossed over how unbelievably illegal and unethical everything he does with that is.
Yes.
But then the whole thing is like, oh, he's this handsome party dude who just fucks models because he's a rich pharmaceutical rep who has an empty heart and life. And then she's this free-spirited artist who has Parkinson's, but she's putting on a brave face and she's all into no strings attached because who could ever love such a sick woman? And it's better if we just have hot sex and I am always game for whatever, even though I'm also very sick. And you're going to fall in love, but then you can't handle it. Goodbye. I will exile you. I exile you. And then he watches their sex tape and he's like, no, I really do love her. It's over.
You see, now, this is the thing is I like they're assholes, and the movie knows they're assholes. So many of these kinds of movies where they think that someone's a lovable asshole, but no, it just seems like a total fucking asshole to me. Oh. But this movie knows, these guys are dicks. Like Anne Hathaway, a lot of her thing is I don't want you to pity me. I don't want you to feel like you're obligated to take care of me because I'm just going to get sicker and sicker. And Jake Gyllenhaal's just a sleazebag. He is so sleazy. But there's the couple things that I like more about this movie. I like that the movie knows that they're assholes and that that's part of the story, you know, because it's kind of two movies. It really is like being an asshole drug rep and all the incredibly shady things he does there, some of which are really funny, but still shady. One running gag is he's supposed to be pushing Xanax And so he really hates the Prozac guy. So he keeps going in this office and taking all the Prozac and throwing it out in the dumpster.
Oh, yes.
And then a homeless guy keeps taking it. And we see the homeless guy get his shit together because of it.
Yeah. Okay. That is the one redeeming thing that I like about this movie. That like storyline is really that,
yeah. Like that's something I was not expecting to see. How R-rated the comedy is. That was really refreshing. It's like, yeah, if this is a movie about people having this like no strings attached fuck buddies thing, then yeah, they're going to be boning a lot. So we get a lot of funny sex scenes and nudity and a ton of boner jokes, including because a huge part of this movie is about him getting to push Viagra.
Well, because it's set in 1996 also. Yeah. So, which is a weird time for it to be set because you forget until someone whips out a pager. You're like, oh, yeah, right. This is supposed to be 1996 because like the whole thing of it is like set around the debut of Viagra. Like
wow.
The big thing is that like Viagra's coming out, a thing no one's ever heard of. And like, I want to be the drug rep that like puts it in everyone. And yeah. I don't necessarily agree. I don't think that the movie knows that Anne Hathaway's an asshole. I think the movie thinks that she, I mean, we know she is, but I think the movie thinks, and I think the movie is trying to tell us that she's just this like tough but wounded sick lady who's just, you know.
No, because I think it shows some scenes of her frustration of like things are getting worse and she has trouble with like the childproof caps and she's like trying to hide that because it's like she doesn't want to admit how sick she is. She doesn't want to scare Jake Gyllenhaal away. She doesn't want to be pitied. And so it gets some of that, like, what it's like to have a constant illness thing in there. So, yeah. Also, I mean, towards the end, Josh Gad is so disgusting in this movie.
The worst.
Yeah, Jake Gyllenhaal's brother. And, I mean, there's a point where Jake Gyllenhaal goes to, like, a sexy party and takes Viagra and then has the four-hour erection, which is very painful. Jake Gyllenhaal deserves all of the awards because I always forget how good he is at comedy. Like he's like running into the bathroom and like pouring, trying to get cold water on his dick and like yelling and then accidentally running into things and screaming. he catches Josh Gad watching his sex tape with his girlfriend and he's like, oh no, I wasn't watching you and my brother have sex. I was staring at her. And he's like, so you were watching my girlfriend while I fucked her. You better start running.
This movie also reminded me that much like I don't want Kevin Costner to ever emote. I just want him to be a fun, cocky asshole. I don't want Jake Gyllenhaal to play like a normal rom-com guy. I want him to always play a weirdo.
Nightcrawler-y guy.
He's so good as a weirdo. Like,
he is so good as a weirdo. But he's really charming when he's being a uber charming asshole. Which also, I just thought of this as like an alternate universe, but it's actually the same characters that they played in Brokeback Mountain. And that makes it really funny.
Damn. That may make me turn on this movie. Because
I am really surprised I'm the one defending the romantic comedy here.
I am too. But you know what? 2020 has had a lot of surprises for all of us. So
yeah. So better than I expected with a lot more boner humor.
Worse than I remembered.
Okay.
And oh my God, I another movie.
All
I might as well go to the bathroom. Peter Gallagher, Julian Hough, Kristen Bell, Stanley Tucci, Alan Cumming, Cam Gigandet, Cher, and Christina Aguilera. Burlesque, a movie I'm not sure I ever heard of.
How much to Los Angeles?
One way or round trip?
You're kidding, right?
All her life, she had a dream.
I want to do that.
But it would take a legend.
Are you Tess?
And you're in my mirror because?
To make it come true.
What is she doing?
I think she's auditioning.
You gotta make me believe that you belong on that stage. There's a curtain. Any questions?
In theaters November 24th.
Woo!
Woo! Okay. So,
all right. Everyone get out of Sarah's way. There she goes.
Affirm me on this. Before we started recording, I was like, guys, I can't wait to talk about Burlesque. And I held up a notebook full of notes that I made. This movie, watching this movie this weekend was the second happiest I felt this entire year after everyone called everything for Joe Biden.
And Total Recall.
So, I experienced all of this in a matter of 2 weeks. But oh my God, could you make a better movie for me? A movie that I am more into. I mean, this movie is basically made for gay men and me. all of the most attractive people in the world. Stanley Tucci playing a gay man is like 100% in my wheelhouse of like what I want in a movie. And he's, you know, this is after Devil Wears Prada, right? So he's basically reprising his role. This movie's fantastic. It is camp without cynicism, which is my favorite thing in the world. It's just a pure expression of like joy of the performing arts, specifically burlesque, which burlesque can get kind of corny. And I do think that we could quibble about, is what is being portrayed in this film really burlesque, or is it more cabaret, or is it more like a combination of the two? Like there's quibbles to be had there 100%. And I mean, I was watching this and Sam came in at one point, and, you know, like it's Christina Aguilera. She's an itty bitty little lady. And like, he was like, I thought burlesque was more like celebrating like more of a fuller figured gal. Yeah. So, and there's not a lot of that there. So that is a quibble with this movie in particular, but oh my God, the performance from Cher, from Christina Aguilera, two of the more powerful female voices in music that we've ever had. And it's just a phenomenal expression of joy. Like, yeah, I mean, the story is the story that we all know. It's like this small town girl goes to the big city, is like, oh, this looks cool. I mean, it's coyote ugly, but burlesque, but way better. Like, it's phenomenal. Well, I 100% recommend it to everyone. The whole time I was watching this, I could not tell if I wanted to look like Cher the entire time or if I wanted to look like Cam Gijonay, because he is the love interest to Christina Aguilera. Also, he's from the Twilight movies, so maybe that might be a thing that you would recognize him from. Also, the first movie I have seen in a very long time that had as like the montage music Ray of Light by Madonna.
Wow, that had to be edited pretty fast.
Yep, good montage. So, all right. So I also love camp, and I really enjoy this movie. I have a list of complaints with it, but I mean, basically it's peachy showgirls. So of course I'm going to love it because I love showgirls, except for there's a very unfortunate violent scene in that. And there's no such problems here. But yes, I also complain that maybe half the numbers they do are actual burlesque numbers and the rest of them, it's just, the whole movie's cabaret without a plot.
100%. Alan Cummings is in it.
That's why I wanted to ask you, why the fuck is Alan Cummings in it for 4 seconds? Except for me expecting him to start singing, you know, welcome and bienvenue, welcome.
That's my only quibble with it myself, is that Alan Cummings is not in it enough. Both dancing and singing. I never really thought of Christina Aguilera as a dancer. I really only thought of her as a singer, and maybe Britney was the dancer, but she pulls it out. There's no real cutting away and she's faking it. She's doing it. She's really doing it.
That's true. There's a lot of dancing. It's very, very jazz, dancey, cabaret, Fosse type stuff, which is not actual burlesque, but is always fun. Kristen Bell, it turns out, she can move pretty well.
Love her, and I love her as a villain too. Really,
yeah, she's fun as a mean girl. She can do that well.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the plot, at the end, it basically comes down to, we're going to save the rec center. I love that they do that through legal minutiae. Yeah, legal minutiae is how they save everything. It's overlong. First of all, it is too solid, and it doesn't need to be that long. We spend a lot of time with Christina and Cam Gigane. Is that how it's? I have no idea how to say that.
Yeah. We can cut all that shit with them. I don't need to see it.
Yeah, there's a lot of, they're burgeoning relationship, but he's got a fiance, but because this is, you know, a rom-com, I guess, she's going to be a giant bitch, and you're going to wonder, like, well, why was he with her in the first place? That really calls into question his character. That bugs me in every one of these kinds of movies where there's, like, the stumbling block fiance, and it's like, why were you with her in the first place if she's horrible? But yeah, it's fun. It turns out Christina Aguilera can act okay. This is her first real big acting thing. She doesn't have to do too much. There's a lot of numbers, a lot of silliness. I think the thing that made me laugh the hardest, though, is Cher's big number. Because she's like, oh, I'm going to lose my club. Oh, I'm so upset about stuff. And then the DJ's like, hey, want to rehearse that big number? She's like, okay. It's a ballad where she stands still.
Yep. Yeah. Makes no sense.
Who's coming to see this? Also, it's only $20 to get in, and there's like anywhere between 5 and 20 dancers and a live band every night.
What?
Yeah, it's like, of course you're losing money.
It doesn't make sense, but again, it's camp, so who cares, you know? I 100% agree with you. I don't think that they should spend as much time on Christina Aguilera and Cam Gijonay's, like, relationship, because it's a foregone conclusion. We know it's going to happen. Two beautiful people end up together. I wish they had spent more time on Stanley Tucci and David Walton hooking up and getting together, because these two beautiful men 100% deserve to be together. And
they're pretty adorable. Yep.
Whole movie to be about that. And also David Walton is a fantastic, hey, it's that guy from TV. But
or the fact that Cher and Peter Gallagher were married, but and they still work together. I kind of, that's like a different thing. And then there's obviously the bad guy developer who is, you know, trying to woo Christina Aguilera. Wait, oh no, it turns out he doesn't have the best intentions. Right. How many cliches can we shove into this movie?
Again, it makes sense. It's camp. And that's played by Eric Dane, who is McSweeney from Grey's Anatomy. Yeah, this is a perfect movie and I 100% endorse it. And I think that if you want to get some joy into your life, you should absolutely watch it.
I have nothing to add here other than I am shocked it was written and directed by the asshole from the Goonies, Troy.
What?
Yeah, the guy looking up girls' dresses in the rearview mirror. And yes, that Steve Anton is the writer-director of this movie.
Well, maybe while he was looking up the girls' dresses, he was getting tips, because the costuming in this movie should have won every single costume award.
They're pretty great.
Yeah. It's perfect. Like, every costume is perfect. And there's a shit ton of them, because hello, we're talking about burlesque. They're fantastic.
Goddamn.
Yep. So I guess, the only way for me also to get Chris into this is the camera ogles these women a lot.
Yay! Come on. What is this, 1960? I'm not going to go see a movie for that reason. I have the internet.
I know. I'm just saying, it's one of those, like, if the girlfriend's like, oh, I want to watch this, and you're like, this is gay camp nonsense.
I don't hate you. Just watching, I only watched the trailer, and it's like, oh, I like this scene in Star is Born. That was fun. Like that movie a lot.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, a little bit of that. Just an injection of joy. It's in the canon, I think, at this point.
Super gay canon. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, like,
come on, it's a musical. It's a modern musical with Cher in it. Duh.
For sure. And Stanley Tucci playing a gay man. I don't know how much more I can sell this to you guys.
I mean, whew. What happened this week? Did all the boy movies just take a week off because of Harry Potter?
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously, very much a movie for women and gay dudes. And yeah, is it a good movie? Like, technically, no, but it's a lot of fun. But it's interesting you mentioned, where are the boy movies? Because the next movie is technically a Disney princess movie that they worked really hard to bring guys into.
Yeah, during the period, Disney was struggling to do that.
Above and beyond to market it to guys, to retrofit the story, to make it more guy-centric, and I think they did a great job.
Yeah, that's why I don't know which Disney Renaissance this is, because if you know the company's history beyond the megalomaniacal empire we know it as today, they were on the verge of, like, not making any more of these types of movies several times throughout their history. And if I'll talk about that more in a second. Donna Murphy, Zach Levi, Andy Moore, Tangled.
I want to see the world.
No can do. Yeah, you're right, we should go.
This Wednesday, grab a friend.
Gotcha!
Hold on tight, because everything's totally tangled. Tangled is an absolute delight.
I can't believe I did this!
An exciting adventure that's laugh out loud funny. 4 stars.
Yeah! This is a very big day!
Tangled, rated PG, starts Wednesday in 3D.
I like Tangled a lot, and it's interesting to look at, what would you call it, Disney going in, post-Pixar Disney, not, like, you know, they rode the Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin success, and Lion King into all that, and then made a lot of notable flops, also trying to appeal to men, like Treasure Planet and Atlantis, Home on the Range, anyone, and they branch into making CG movies like Pixar, and no offense to Bolt or Meet the Robinsons, but they're hardly what you know, no one's calling Chicken Little a classic. And then, oddly enough, re-find success for themselves in a movie long in development. I remember as a little kid, my sister and I, our parents were like, what movie do you want to see Disney make next? Because they're all based on public domain fairy tales. And we always said Rapunzel. And it's just odd that I didn't get that until I was 30.
It is weird that it took that long.
Yeah, I guess they didn't think there was enough there. But like Diana said, they make Rapunzel half about a guy, which is a pretty crazy rewrite of the tale, but also how they make it not a full-on princess movie and get more people in. I believe this movie holds the unadjusted statistic as the most expensive movie ever made. I think there are several versions of this movie out there somewhere, including a traditionally animated one, is in production for 6 years. And it did all those things that if you were around in the late 90s that the Disney company said they weren't going to do again. We're not going to do princess movies. We're not going to do fairy tales. And we're not going to do musicals. It did all that and redefined itself by its old definition and that rode that success into Frozen. It's just, it's interesting. And the movie's fantastic.
Would you call Tangled's not a musical? I would call it.
It's got songs.
Oh, absolutely. It's a musical. There's a couple times where they have numbers. They break into song.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. I'm thinking more of the traditional Disney musical. Like, can anyone name a song from Tangled?
No, I cannot. But I mean, I think Mandy Moore's cast for a reason because I hadn't seen her.
There's the Villain number by the abusive mom, and there's all the bad guys singing about their girly hobbies.
Absolutely. But I mean,
Yeah, there's no Let It Go here.
But I think they were testing the waters to do that again. That has always been part of the Disney formula for success, that the public kind of, you know, in the 60s, in the 70s, they kind of wane in their interest in that. There are fewer songs, and then it always comes back with Frozen. But
in the 90s.
Huh?
The musical idea of, like, bringing it at least a hit song out of every Disney movie was like a juggernaut during the 90s.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But also something like they would stray away from whenever the public's taste in fantastical musicals would wane, like Fox and the Hound. Robin Hood has songs, but like not really musical numbers. Wasn't really in vogue at the time, but it always comes back. It always comes back around. And Tangled is a movie that holds up. I recently re-experienced it through Kingdom Hearts 3, with all the voice cast coming back. And I really like the cast. It's not a bunch of like major celebrities. It's just like the right people for every role. And I love Flynn Rider. I think I didn't realize I was quoting him until my girlfriend told me yesterday. I put the dog in front of the camera and like, prepare for the smolder. And boom.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Zachary Levi is like, he's like charm personified, man. He's just so Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, charming. Shazam, charming as hell.
Yeah.
He just does.
And for me, I remember I was at E3 hosting a live show and someone just whispers in my ear like, Zach Levi is going to jump on your show. And like that whole time is a blur. It's like, oh, I don't have to do anything. Zach Levi showed up and just handled our shit for us. Thanks, man. Nice guy. As well. And
I think a lot of people would like Zachary Levi to handle their shit.
Mm-hmm. And I remember Paul F. Tompkins saying they had to change the character's name because he was drunk guy and is very clearly drunk. And now I'm looking, it's like Short Thug. Okay.
Also, just this means nothing to anyone besides me, but this is the first movie that I took my niece to. My oldest niece. This was her first movie that we took her to.
That's so cool.
Yeah, I think they were brilliant to lean into the action because normally Rapunzel does one thing. She puts her hair down, she pulls someone up.
She's isolated.
And here she uses it, you know, like a giant whip that she's constantly using it to tie people up, to grab things, to swing over here. You know, it's her superpower, both literally and figuratively.
It's the perfect definition of why I love what Disney does to old stories and why I hate live action remakes. This is a completely original spin on a story you think you know. And the 101 Dalmatians remake is not. It is just a mildly more expensive one with less animation. Who likes that? It was Rapunzel at one point, became Tangled, the same way the Snow Queen became Frozen. And yeah, I don't know. I like stories like that where Disney ends up not redefining themselves, but like reestablishing themselves and feeling more confident in who they are, finding themselves again and again and again, which they do tend to after abandoning princess.
I think a little bit of what they're finding here is I think they're learning a little thing from Shrek, though.
Yeah, I think so too.
Some of the comedy does not feel as Disney-y. Like Maximus the Horse, who I laughed every single time he popped up. He's so fucking funny.
Yeah, there's a Tangled... the Tangled short films, I think, in particular, have been excellent. They're awesome. And they mostly star Pascal and the horse. And
Maximus the Horse, who just takes his job way too seriously and is going to track people down. And it's like, but you're a horse. What are you going to do when you find them? Yeah. He doesn't care. He's very angry. He has a job to do.
Yeah, I can't say enough nice things about Tangled, and it brought in this new era of confidence and maybe some plucked Pixar personnel to make Disney animated movies. Do you remember when, like, ooh, the new Pixar movie? Who gives a shit about the new Disney movie? That's where we were. They were making stuff like Bolt. They were still distributing things like Ghibli movies. I think I looked up list of Disney movies before this, like the last movie before this was Tales of Earthsea. That can't be. Oh, they distributed Ghibli stuff.
They distribute it. No, I guess the proper one was Princess and the Frog, right?
Yes.
Which is traditionally animated and wonderful, but didn't catch on.
Yeah, but that this movie was in production before that one. And I haven't seen footage of it, but with mostly like traditional animators. So I do think it changed so much from title and character. I have to imagine there's probably a more traditionally animated version of this movie partially completed out there. They don't reveal that stuff too much, but I'm sure it's out there for Tangled. Again, I think it's the most expensive movie ever made, technically. Like over $300 million over 6 years in production.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
So I rewatched this again, and my husband had never seen it. So we watched it together, and it was fun that he's laughing out loud, just like I am, and we're grown-ass adults, no kids around.
Yeah.
But I think what grabbed me this time is, you know, she's held captive by an emotionally abusive narcissist.
Mm-hmm.
And the evil mom, who is Donna Murphy, is mostly a stage actress who's fucking great in this. She's like, she's such a recognizable kind of selfish mom that it's like, I really wonder if there are little kids out there who are watching and it's like, she's mean the way mommy's mean.
Oh, goodness.
And she's the bad guy.
Oh, no.
Ergo, when I turn 18, I should get the fuck out of here.
Cut my hair into a cute pixie cut.
Wow.
Yeah. Get the fuck out. I guess that was like, if we want to spoil the end of the movie, this is my one big complaint is that Flynn makes a huge decision for her in her powers. And that's not really fair.
Mm-hmm.
I would like it more if she made that decision of like, oh, you want me to live with you forever and you can use my magic hair for shit? Okay, cut my hair. Ha ha, fuck you. I wish it went more like that in Tangled instead of Flynn being like, no, here, I'll save you from this lady by like fucking up your superpower.
Mm.
That's not cool.
Life was on the line, man.
I know.
I think it gets overshadowed by the successes that followed, but like,
yeah,
it doesn't get Little Mermaid status as in the previous Disney Renaissance, but I think it should. It holds up particularly well. It's great. And I think they may have had rougher CG technology, but like really went the extra mile in trying to make the backgrounds kind of look like paintings. And it just, yeah, that's a choice, and it holds up better than trying to make everything photorealistic. Mm-hmm. And it's totally worth another watch. I haven't seen it. I want to. I had the Blu-ray. I have not watched it in 4K on Disney Plus. I can tell you this is streaming on Disney Plus.
Of course it is.
But with that out of the way, we have only one notable thing to talk about in TV, but it also features Anne Hathaway and SNL, hosted by Anne Hathaway with musical guest Florence plus the Machine. God, I wish he said that live.
I wanted to say this when we were talking about Love and Other Drugs, but I do think this is probably where the Anne Hathaway fatigue started to set in, right?
I think so.
I think this is probably, because like, when did she host the Oscars with James Franco?
I think that's not for another few years.
I want to say it's this year or next year.
Oh, okay. Shit, really?
So yeah, I really think that this is when the fatigue started to set in with Anne Hathaway. But here she is on SNL hosting with Florence and the Machine, two very 2010 things to say. But there's not a lot of going on in TV this week. I did want to pull. This is the last appearance of a Kristen Wiig character that, I don't know, I find this character to be underrated. I really enjoy this character, but she's also very annoying, so maybe I'm the only person. Anne Hathaway is running a soup kitchen during Thanksgiving, and this is Kristen Wiig's character, Penelope, who is like the one-upper. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I barely.
Seeing all these wonderful faces here today, it really warms my heart.
It warms my heart, too.
Mine's burning a lot, though. It's like a little ball of fire under my bra. Can't say the Pledge of Allegiance or I'll burn my hands. So I guess my heart's a little warmer than yours.
Oh, well. Thank you, Penelope, was it? Oh, good. Well, as I was saying, Thanksgiving is a special time for me. Interesting fact, thanks to Ancestry.com, I just found out that I had relatives come over on the Mayflower. My relatives came over on the April flower. So they got here 1 month before yours did.
I loved so much, and I feel like she did not get a lot of love, but she's like a character that like one-ups everything everyone says, and then at the end usually there's like a great reveal that shows that like everything she was saying, which is totally nonsensical, is absolutely true. And
so she did come over in the April flowers.
Yeah, exactly. And that's true for this sketch, and the ending has a great payoff. But yeah, Kristen Wiig, I feel like, has a high percentage of beloved characters and characters that people find annoying. And I tend to love all of them. And I really love the Penelope character. But this was the last sighting of her.
Well, fare thee well, Penelope. Oh, wait. And then, again, we're going to go way more in depth on the video games. Patreon.com/LaserTime. But the video games for this week, 20th to the 26th of November. Donkey Kong Country Returns is out on the Wii. It's a fantastic game. Raving Rabbids Travel in Time. Michael can talk about that because he may have worked on it. But not at this time. It was 10 years ago. Split Second, an underrated Disney racing game. Back when Disney had a studio that named after itself. Michael Jackson, The Experience, that'll never get old. One of my favorite games ever, Pac-Man Champion Edition DX hits PSN. Splatterhouse, talked about in a recent Video Game Apocalypse with Michael. The last game in the Splatterhouse series is now 10 years old. Can you feel it, 30, 40-year-olds? Tangled, the video game. It wouldn't have been 10 years ago without a Tangled video game. Just want to say the word Funky Lab Rat. I have no idea what that is, but that's a game. And Gran Turismo 5 is out this week for everyone, actually. Please enjoy your beautiful, boring car porn. And with that, we are pretty much done with the show. Diane is going to tell us who died and who was born during this period. I'm supposed to tell you to support patreon.com/lasertime. For the price of $5, you can keep us all doing this show and other shows in the Laser Time Network and other shows that we put up exclusively for patrons, including Sick of Star Wars, an extended version of the video games that came out 30, 20, and 10 years ago, and some movie commentaries that are slowly trickling in addition to 100 previously backlog ones. And a weekly show I am trying to keep up with in the weirdest, worst week of my life. I'm fine. Don't cry for me. But a weekly bonus show we try and do. Sam and Sarah were on our last one, which was an election special, post-election special. Diana, where can people find you?
They can find me on the Twitter at ListenaNerd, LecinNerd, or follow the show at 302010 podcast, 302010 podcast. And teasing next week, we've got one of the best Stephen King horror adaptations.
Ooh, okay.
And oh, I know. Speaking of horror, in 2000, we will have a fun trip through addiction that is not. Oh God,
hard pass.
makes me feel bad for Wayans for the first time in my life.
I know this very well. Oh my goodness! And with that, who died during this period?
Well, the only person I could find died is 30 years ago this week, 1990. We lost Roald Dahl, who was 74, who wrote every famous children's book ever.
And he didn't live to see Anne Hathaway fatigue, nor her appearance in his Witches. No,
Witches, Fantastic Mr. Fox, BFG, James and Giant Peach, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Not a big fan of Jews or women's or non-whites, but besides that, God.
It's like every white guy's curse from back then. Ugh.
2 years ago that you informed me of his personal beliefs.
Oh, birthday is a doodly doo, a ding dong doodly doodly ding dong doo.
Upper class British person born in 1916. Like, he's going to have some biases, and it was the style of the time. I mean, it can't take Charlie and the Chocolate Factory away from us, or Matilda, so come on.
Cool. We didn't mention Matilda. Good. And with that out of the way, now that we know who's dead, we got to see who's alive, who was born during this period of 30, 2010, the 20th through the 26th of November, across three decades. Birthdays!
Born November 21st, 1945. Happy 75th birthday to this woman, born in Washington, D.C. She started ballet at age 3, worked as a professional dancer all the way through her 20s, running a ballet school, and as a go-go dancer. I could not believe I learned something amazing about her. Her first husband was Gus Tregonis, who was a dancer in West Side Story, and he directed one of those underrated Mystery Science Theaters ever, Sidehackers.
Oh, Sidehackers is great. It's the thing to do.
Yeah, she apparently is an extra in it, if you look for it really carefully.
Is it Cher?
No.
Okay. Is it Martha Graham?
No, but I knew Chris would not get Martha Graham, so I'm not going to...
I did not know. Not even when Sarah said it.
You guys always be like old-timey animators that I don't know who they are. Just kidding.
Okay. But she broke up with Gus Tricanis, and she dated Franco Nero and Tom Selleck and won an Oscar for her film debut.
Whoa. Dated Tom Selleck. Is he older than him?
I believe so.
Holy crap. Is it the girl from Beasts of the Southern Wild? I didn't remember.
75. She looks amazing.
Amazing.
All right. So films of hers we have talked about. I did not also learn she was an executive producer on My Blue Heaven.
Wait. Fuck. Keep going.
We've also talked about Everyone Says I Love You, Wildcats, and The Out-of-Towners.
Keep going. There's so many people in Everyone Says I Love You.
Bird on a Wire. Overboard.
Goldie Hawn.
There you go. Goldie Hawn and First Wives Club.
Yeah.
Also, Goldie is her birth name. That is not a nickname.
Wow. I didn't know she dated Tom Selleck.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know she was 75. I just put on Snatch 75. The other day just to see what it was like, and my girlfriend said, please no. And like,
no, it wasn't terrible.
I was willing to check it out.
Yeah. I'm so sad that you guys talked about First Wives Club before I came on the scene, because... I think you can imagine I have a lot of opinions about that movie, and they're all that this is one of the best movies ever made.
Spoken like a true second wife. And
agree.
Okay, with that, why don't you pick the closer, Sarah, since I just insulted you.
Yeah.
Diana gave us a lot of options.
We had so much music just for 2010. I mean, we got Tangled and Burlesque are both musicals. We got My Dark Twisted Fantasy, so...
I mean, so I really want to direct people to the Burlesque soundtrack because it's just Christina and Cher and it's wonderful, but I just have to go off my gut as to what is my favorite thing that I've listened to that we've talked about, and it's Call Your Girlfriend by Robin.
Oh, okay. All right, well, listen to it and tell me if it sounds like Isn't She Lovely by Stevie Wonder, because it is!
I Believe You Die. You can tell us more on our Facebook, on the Twitters, in the comments of the show. We do really, really love and appreciate your feedback. Again, your memories are just as important as ours, so it's nice to get an impression of what other people were doing and what they think about things that we may or may not agree with them on. I genuinely want to see people... properly trash Dances with Wolves to bring me back to my senses. So I invite that as well.
I always want people to watch Burlesque.
This episode has like the highest ratio of recommends in here. I mean, between the three of us, we recommended all the movies from 1990, half the movies from 2000, and most of the movies from 2010. So
there's a Muppet special in there. I would have closed out with just one thing. Have you ever heard Big Bird and Elmo and Fraggles and Muppets singing to your face about Jim Henson's death? It's wonderful. All right, take us out, Robin. We will see you guys next week. Tell a friend about the show. Thank you. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.